You're listening to the Triangle Radio Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the Holiday 2018-2019 issue and the February 2019 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Moonshots. Apollo 11, a new documentary that features freshly unearthed footage of the famous 1969 lunar mission, is as much a cinematic discovery as a celestial one. By David Camp. Opening photo, Giant Steps. The crew of Apollo 11, Buzz Aldrin, Michael Collins, and Neil Armstrong on their way to the launch pad at Kennedy Space Center in Florida on July 16, 1969. At the outset of making his new documentary, Apollo 11, Todd Douglas Miller had a pro forma conversation with his contact at the National Archives and Records Administration, Dan Rooney, about what he was working on. Rooney is the supervisory archivist in NARA's Motion Picture Sound and Video Branch in College Park, Maryland, which is the final repository for, among other things, any extant films whose production was underwritten by the U.S. government. As its working title indicates, Apollo 11, which will be released next year in a 90-minute cut for movie theaters, there will also be a 40-minute version for museums, is about the most famous and celebrated of all the missions carried out by the National Aeronautics and Space Administration. The one that made Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin the first two human beings to walk on the moon on July 20, 1969. The 50th anniversary of this landmark was coming up, and Miller was looking for a fresh approach to telling the story of the mission without using the same old footage, tropes, and imagery. He didn't quite know what he was after at NARA, but Rooney was intrigued when Miller mentioned that his production company, Statement Pictures, is a player in the large format world of IMAX pictures. So I casually told Todd, "Well, we do have large format NASA materials, and I know we have 70mm, but we've never really had the opportunity to look under the hood and see what's there," Rooney told me. He decided to investigate. In May of last year, Miller received a startling email from Rooney. "I was used to the way in which archivists and librarians communicate, which is typically very monotone, very even-keel," Miller said. "But I get this email from Dan, and it's just insanely long and full of exclamation points and bolded words." Rooney's staff had located a cache of largely unprocessed film that he identified as the 65mm Panavision collection. In this format, the negative is shot on 65mm film and then printed as a 70mm positive. The collection consists of approximately 165 source reels of materials covering Apollo 8 through Apollo 13, Rooney wrote. "Thus far, we have definitively identified 61 of those 165 that relate directly to the Apollo 11 mission, including astronaut mission preparations, launch, recovery, and astronaut engagement, and tours after the mission. These are exciting finds, and we think it could change your direction significantly," Rooney concluded. The specific 70mm format in which the footage had been printed was the Todd AO process, the one used for such 50s and 60s cinematic extravaganzas as Around the World in 80 Days and The Sound of Music, back when the movie industry was doing ever bigger and wider to compete was going ever bigger and wider to compete with the threat of television. But what was staid NASA doing shooting in Todd A.O. in 1969, by which point the format was in decline. Part of the explanation lies in a film called Moonwalk 1, directed by a man named Theo Kamecki. A couple of years before the Apollo 11 mission, NASA had put together a deal with MGM Studios and the filmmaker Francis Thompson, a pioneer in producing proto-IMAX giant screen documentaries, to make a picture that would tell the story of the entire Apollo program. But on short notice, MGM backed out. 6 weeks before Apollo 11's launch, NASA, eager to salvage some aspect of the project, asked Thompson if he was still game to do something. By then, busy with other projects, he recommended Kamecki, his editor. Moonwalk 1, the kaleidoscopic, vaguely trippy movie that resulted, narrated by Lawrence Luckinbill, is a pretty good artifact of the era, and has over time acquired status as a cult film. But it died a death at the time of its 1972 release, when a saturated public was simply over Apollo Mania. Much of the widescreen motherlode that came to light at NARA consisted of reels, never processed, from Kamecki's project, and some of it was footage shot by NASA itself, presumably for public relations purposes. Next photos, Space Odyssey, scenes from the Apollo 11 documentary, and guest in the VIP viewing stands at Kennedy Space Center, the 5.5 million pound crawler transporter and rocket launcher, the Saturn V at liftoff. As exhilarating as Rooney's news was for Miller, it presented a technological challenge. NARA didn't have 60s-era Todd A.O. projectors to screen these materials, let alone the equipment to transfer them to digital. But Miller's project presented Rooney and NARA with a golden opportunity for a private entity to underwrite the digitization and preservation of materials that, because they are part of the National Archives, belong to the public. An arrangement was worked out to do just that. The post-production shop with which Miller works in New York, Final Frame, rigged up custom hardware and software just for the Apollo 11 project in order to scan the Todd A.O. footage to digital. As the old reels scanned through Final Frame's machinery and their contents played out on a screen, Miller and Rooney couldn't believe their good fortune. "Our jaws were on the floor," Miller said. What they saw, scene after magnificent scene, in pristine, unfaded color, of vignettes from the historic mission. They watched footage of the mission's mighty Saturn V rocket being carried to its launch pad on a crawler transporter, a massive contraption that looks more Lucasfilm than NASA. A quarter-acre-size hunk of platform mounted atop slow-rolling tank treads. They watched a pan across a waterside JCPenney store whose parking lot had become a de facto campsite for spectators, packed with moms, dads, and kids in the rust and mustard-colored Banlon leisure wear of the period, drowsily biding their time in the Florida heat until the launch, which was scheduled for 9:32 a.m. Most movingly, they viewed intimately close shots of the astronauts, Armstrong, the mission commander, Aldrin, the lunar module pilot, and Michael Collins, the command module pilot, in the suit-up room at Kennedy Space Center, their faces weighted with the profundity of what they were about to undertake, while Tex in white scrub caps fluttered around them like fashion stylist, checking their fasteners and headsets. It was like a family discovering a forgotten shoebox full of old Super 8 movies, of major life events and departed friends. Only the family was America. The movies were of theater quality. The event was one of the most important accomplishments in human history, and the departed friend was Neil Armstrong. Apollo 11, the mission, is the climactic chapter of an epic American tale. The story begins in 1957, when, in the middle of the Cold War, the Soviet Union launches into orbit Earth's first artificial satellite, Sputnik 1. This triggers the space race between the Soviets and the Americans, the establishment of NASA in 1958, and John F. Kennedy's 1961 address to Congress, in which he proclaims that the U.S. should land a man on the moon before this decade is out. The lead-up to 1969 is a succession of dense, incident-rich chapters that encompass NASA's Project Mercury, which sends the first American astronauts into orbit, the Gemini program, which develops and hones techniques for prolonged spaceflight, and the early to mid stages of the Apollo program, where preparations for a moon landing begin in earnest. The first manned moon mission, which takes place from July 16th to July 24th of 1969, is where time stretches out and the story slows down. Luxuriating in every detail of the journey that finally deposits Armstrong and Aldrin on the lunar surface and then brings them and Collins safely home. Apollo 11, the film, covers just those 9 days, give or take a few digressions, backward and forward. But, as Miller learned, within these days lie layers upon layers of narrative, because they represented the culmination of years of work by thousands of people. Like Damien Chazelle, whose Neil Armstrong biopic, First Man, was released in October, Miller was keen to transcend the familiar highlights, such as Armstrong's famous article-challenged first words on the lunar surface. What he meant to say was that's one small step for a man, one giant leap for mankind, and tell the mission's story in a new way. Miller began work on Apollo 11 in 2016 when Courtney Sexton, vice president at CNN Films. The News Network's documentary division contacted him to see if he had any bright ideas on how they might commemorate the moon landing's 50th anniversary. Her request didn't come out of the blue. At the time, Miller was completing a digital documentary short for CNN Films called The Last Steps about Apollo 17, the final manned mission to the moon, which took place in December 1972. Effectively, the epic tale's quiet denouement. Next photo, Rocket Men. NASA managers Walter Caprian, Rocco Petrone, and Kurt Debuse watch from Kennedy's Launch Control Center. While putting together The Last Steps, Miller and his producing partner, Tom Peterson, hit upon a formula that they would apply to the new film, telling the story entirely in the present tense, using only archival materials, with no present-day talking heads reflecting back on past events. Even the musical cues are archival. One day, Peterson was listening to the onboard audio of the astronauts yakking amongst themselves on the eve of the moon landing when they were out of ground range. While they were inspecting the condition of the lunar module, Aldrin casually said, "Let's get some music." A few minutes into his listening in, Peterson picked up some faint baritone singing in the background. He initially took this to be a Johnny Cash song, but after listening for more clues, he determined that what he was hearing was "Mother Country" by the singer-songwriter John Stewart, off of Stewart's then-latest album, California Bloodlines. As it turns out, NASA, ever mindful of efficiency, equipped each crew member with a Sony TC-50 cassette recorder, a sort of proto-Walkman, for the purpose of logging mission notes verbally rather than with pen and paper. Instead of blasting off with only blank cassettes, the astronauts took tapes that had been pre-filled with music befitting their taste by NASA's friends in the music industry, most notably the record company executive Mickey Kapp. Mother Country, a bittersweet, not un-Cash-esque ballad about American heroism and the elastic meaning of the phrase "the good old days," proved a perfect allegorical fit for Miller and Peterson's storytelling, and they use it to good effect in the film. While the Todd A.O. footage was Miller's most thrilling archival find, it wasn't the only one. In the course of making the last steps, the director won the trust of the community of hardcore civilian space enthusiasts who self-identify as space nerds. Since NASA, like NARA, is a federal agency of limited resources, it has, to a surprising extent, crowdsourced much of the curation of its own past. For example, while the agency hosts the impressively thorough Apollo Flight Journal and Apollo Lunar Surface Journal websites, which offer full transcripts and some playable recordings of the air-to-ground audio for Apollo missions 7 to 17, these sites were built and are still maintained by a dedicated core of volunteers. One of them is Stephen Slater, a 31-year-old independent archivist based in Sheffield, England, who, though he has no formal background in aerospace, has amassed one of the world's most impressive libraries of Apollo film footage. Slater's pet project, or demented passion, depending upon how you look at it, is to sync the soundless 16mm footage that NASA cameramen shot at Mission Control during Apollo 11 to the audio recordings that survive. This involves poring over old, haphazardly cataloged snippets of film in search of visual clues, such as a clock face visible in the frame, indicating the time, and then matching this information to the timestamps in the transcripts, and then trying to locate the corresponding dialogue in NASA's vast trove of mission audio. It's an incredibly tedious process, but rewarding when it pays off. When I got Gene Kranz saying, "We're go for landing," it was like, "Oh my God," Slater told me. Kranz was the flight director on duty at the time of the lunar module's descent, and was later memorably portrayed in all of his brush-cut, vest-wearing splendor by Ed Harris in Ron Howard's movie Apollo 13. Slater assembled a clip in which Kranz is seen issuing his historic command, followed immediately by another synced shot in which Charlie Duke, then on duty as Capcom, the capsule communicator, a ground-based astronaut whose job it is to communicate directly with the crew of the spacecraft, relays Kranz's command to Armstrong and Aldrin in the lunar module, "Eagle, Houston, you're go for landing. Over." Slater was conscripted by Miller to apply his expertise to Apollo 11. "The sound-synced shots," Slater said, "remove any suggestion that this is generic footage. It makes it so much more powerful to me, knowing that we are watching the actual moment, almost as if Todd had been shooting in there with his own film crew." Slater's efforts were complemented by the work of another esteemed member of the space nerd firmament, Ben Feist. By profession, the 47-year-old Feist is the head of technology at an ad agency in Toronto, but he spends the better part of his off hours applying his formidable coding skills to the creation of such astonishing reconstitutions of space history as Apollo 17 org, which he launched 3 years ago, aggregating publicly available audio transcripts and moving and still images into an immersive real-time mission experience of humankind's most recent trip to the moon. He also happens to be the older brother of Leslie Feist, the Canadian singer-songwriter who performs as Feist. Through his correspondence with NASA, Feist learned of a bounty of newly available mission audio that no filmmaker had worked with. During the Apollo era, the agency had two 30-track tape recorders running concurrently in Houston that captured not only the flight director's commands to his subordinates, but also all the so-called backroom loops, the channels through which NASA's various headset-wearing controllers and support teams communicated with one another. If you picture the people sitting in mission control, each one is sitting at a different station, Feist told me, and if you want to hear what the flight dynamics officer was talking about with the guidance officer at a certain moment, you just turn on those two channels, and you can hear what those guys were saying. Until recently, it was nigh on impossible to hear what any of these guys were saying, because the antique analog 30-track recordings had been neither digitized nor separated into their component tracks. But in a timely stroke of good fortune for Miller, a team of sound engineers at the University of Texas at Dallas recently completed a multi-year labor-intensive program to transform these tapes, which include upwards of 10,000 hours of audio for Apollo 11 alone, spread over 60 channels into digital files. Slater clued in Miller to the files, and Feist wrote software to improve their fidelity. For Miller and Peterson, this cleaned-up 30-track audio was another means with which to tell the story of the mission in the present tense. One of its most fraught moments, familiar to space nerds but not to the general public, occurred just 7.5 minutes before the scheduled touchdown on the moon. An alarm reading 1202 went off on the guidance computer of the lunar model, Eagle, not once, but several times, and was soon joined by a second alarm reading 1201. Neither Armstrong nor Aldrin was familiar with these codes. This set off a scramble at Mission Control in Houston to figure out what was going on. Fortunately, a 24-year-old flight software specialist who worked in one of the back rooms, Jack Garman, quickly determined what was happening, an executive overflow or data overload that was not mission-threatening. His reassurance was relayed up the chain of command and into outer space in time for Eagle to land. This episode is glancingly depicted in First Man, but thanks to the 30-track audio, the 1202 program alarm story can be heard in Apollo 11 in its full verite unfolding. You actually hear the kid savior Garman telling his guidance officer, Steve Bales, that if the alarm doesn't reoccur, Eagle should be go for landing. Early one morning this past summer, I joined a small group of people who had gathered at the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum in Washington, D.C., for a private screening of Apollo 11's first 30 minutes. When the lights came up in the museum's IMAX theater, Miller took questions and comments from the audience. One fellow near the back, at age 87, the oldest at the gathering, happened to be a former director of the Air and Space Museum. He pronounced what he had just witnessed magnificent. He did note, however, that the film's launch sequence, as effective as he found it, doesn't quite capture the jerky lateral motion that the astronauts felt after liftoff, which he likened to being inside a wide car being driven by a novice down a narrow road. One might have been inclined to ask the old-timer how he could be so damned sure of this, were it not for the fact that he was none other than Michael Collins, Major General USAF, retired, and NASA astronaut from 1963 to 1970. If anything, Apollo 11, in its high-res, hi-fi revisitation of those 9 days in 1969, invites further curiosity about what great untapped tales of the mission remained to be told. Who, for example, is the lone woman controller seen among all the men in white shirts and skinny black neckties as the camera pans over the firing room at Kennedy Space Center on the day of the launch, in the third row back? What were the circumstances that placed her there? Actually, I tracked her down and spoke with her. Her name is Joanne Morgan, and she was a 28-year-old instrumentation controller at the time, and the only woman permitted in the firing room once it was locked down at T-minus 30 minutes. Just short of 500 men and me, she said with a laugh. Morgan had worked for NASA almost since its inception, starting as an engineer's aide during her summers off from the University of Florida. But Apollo 11 marked the first time she was working a mission as a senior-level controller. Morgan later learned that her very presence in the room had been the subject of serious discussion, with the matter going all the way up to Kennedy Space Center's director, Kurt Debuse, one of the elite German rocket scientists who came to the U.S. after World War II as part of Wernher von Braun's team. "It was no big deal to Dr. Debuse," Morgan told me. Still, she said, she experienced tidbits of resistance regarding her presence in the Apollo program. "I got obscene phone calls on my telephone at my console a couple of times," she said. And, like Dr. Katherine Johnson in the movie Hidden Figures, Morgan had to trek to a completely different building in order to use a bathroom, albeit in her case for a different discriminatory reason, not because of segregation, but because there simply wasn't a women's bathroom in the building where she worked. All by herself, Joanne Morgan would make for a pretty good documentary. As it is, she is a flicker on the screen, a thread in the Apollo 11 tapestry. Ben Feist, hopeful of weaving back together as many of these threads as possible, is building a companion website to the Apollo 11 movie that will be like his Apollo 17 site, but even more thorough, with clickable access to the flight controller's audio channels and the opportunity for users to offer their own commentary and contributions. "If you find something on one of the channels," he said, "you'll be able to open up a discussion in a forum and say, 'Hey, I found this thing. What is it?' Because there's real interesting things in there." As engrossing as it is, Apollo 11 is not the last word on Apollo 11.
Thank you.
Now we move on to the February 2019 issue of Vanity Fair magazine, which features Laura Dern on the cover. Now for the Vanity Fair agenda, promotion, and events. Watch 25th Annual Screen Actors Guild Awards on TNT and TBS. Celebrate the SAG Awards Silver Anniversary on Sunday, January 27th, as some of today's leading actors are honored for the year's outstanding film and television performances. For the only entertainment industry awards that focus solely on actors, ballots are cast by nearly 121,000 SAG-AFTRA members. Find out their choices right when they do during the 25th Annual SAG Awards on TNT-TBS. Don't miss the 8 p.m. Eastern Time beginning to share the surprise when a secret few of their peers disclose their personal take on the show's signature I'm an Actor stories. Watch for the awards and stay for the camaraderie, the fashion, and the unexpected things, be they provocative, humorous, or heartfelt, that pop out of actors' mouths when they accept the actor statuette. Event: Vanity Fair and Martin Scorsese present Stan and Ollie. On Sunday, December 9th at Neuhaus in New York City, Vanity Fair and Oscar-winning filmmaker and historian Martin Scorsese co-hosted a special screening of Stan and Ollie, the buddy biopic of Stan Laurel and Oliver Hardy. Director John S. Baird, screenwriter Jeff Pope, makeup designer Mark Coulier, and stars John C. Reilly and Steve Coogan were in attendance, participating in a panel discussion post-screening moderated by Vanity Fair's Mike Hogan. Event: Vanity Fair and Focus Features celebrate Mary, Queen of Scots. On December 6th, Vanity Fair and Focus Features hosted a private cocktail reception to celebrate Mary, Queen of Scots, the critically acclaimed story about Mary Stuart's attempt to overthrow her cousin, Elizabeth I, Queen of England. This invitation-only event was held at the Chateau Marmont, where guests were treated to a first-hand look at the film's elaborate costumes designed by Alexandra Byrne.
Thank you.
Now for some of the contributors to this month's issue. Sloane Crosley, Laura Dern's Moment. Laura Dern is a true examiner of the world, says the Vanity Fair contributing editor, whose latest collection of essays, Look Alive Out There, will be published in paperback in April. After interviewing this month's cover star, Crosley changed her screensaver to a still from Citizen Ruth, of Dern huffing spray paint. Julia Hetta, Laura Dern's Moment. I've been following Laura Dern since her work with David Lynch, and her characters have always fascinated me, says the Swedish photographer who shot Dern in New York. I was equally fascinated when I met her. She's filled with humor and isn't afraid of breaking boundaries. Micaiah Carter, The Wheel Deal. Combining elements of the Black Power movement across several decades created a timeless yet unique feel to the image, says Carter, who shot the subjects of the upcoming HBO documentary United States. The Brooklyn-based photographer is currently at work on his first monograph. Lawrence Leamer, Tricks of His Trade. The Palm Beach resident, whose new book, Mar-a-Lago, is adapted in this issue, had Thanksgiving dinner at the president's resort. I kept thinking, is Trump going to condemn Mar-a-Lago as fake news, or will he say, I got it right? Evgenia Peretz, Code of Silence. The story about Kavanaugh's circle at Georgetown Prep, says the Vanity Fair contributing editor, led me to another story that was unforeseen, a sex abuse scandal that had some of the hallmark traits of the larger Catholic Church crisis. Juliet Naked, a film co-written by Peretz, was released this past summer.
Thank you.
Here's the editor's letter from February 2019 from Radhika Jones, editor. I watched Laura Dern's HBO series Enlightened when it was on the air from 2011 to 2013. I remember feeling there was nothing else like it on television for its singular focus on an imperfect woman working to put rage behind her and in so doing unleashing a different, very potent kind of energy. It was the perfect role for Dern, if not quite perfect for the moment. As she tells Sloane Crosley in our cover profile, if Enlightened were on right now, given what's happening in the world, every woman would say, I am Amy Jellicoe. But when it was on, male journalists would interview me and relate, and female journalists would ask, how do you feel playing such an unattractive character? Luckily, we have caught up to Dern and the complicated woman for whom she acts as unofficial cultural symbol. Sloane captures her in all her warmth, and photographer Julia Hetta portrays her as a source of light. Now may be the winter of our discontent, but here is Laura Dern, our sun. Or maybe it's just the winter of Donald Trump's discontent. We mark the post-midterm shift in Washington with a portfolio shot by Martin Schuller of some of the political luminaries whose names will populate your newsletters and media feeds in the coming year, from the House committee chairs tasked with oversight of the executive branch to Ben Shapiro, Wunderkind Trump critic of the conservative Daily Wire, to Joe Biden, who still equivocates Hamlet-like over the prospective 2020 Democratic field. Nancy Pelosi reclaims the Speaker's gavel while Congress welcomes a record number of women beginning their political careers, from New York's Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez to Minnesota's Ilhan Omar. And Michael Bloomberg, newly registered Democrat and recent Iowa visitor, rises over New York's East River in a gondola. Does his view stretch as far as the White House? Fake tycoons have done it. Why not a real one? As I write, Vanity Fair is joining with Bloomberg Philanthropies in London to present an exchange of ideas and calls to action on climate change and sustainability. With the catastrophic reports coming from various scientific bodies over the past few months as to warming Arctic temperatures and increasing carbon emissions, as well as a World Health Organization report projecting the millions of lives that could be saved over the next few decades. If the commitments of the Paris Agreement are met, it's clear that there's no time to wait or waste. My son, who is 4, is obsessed with dinosaurs, which have led him to a fascination with extinction events. The thing that strikes me as I read to him of the Permian extinction that preceded the Triassic explosion of life, or the asteroid that cut down Tyrannosaurus Rex in its prime, is the hubris it takes to think that such events could only happen in the past. The difference between us and the dinosaurs is that we can see our fate coming, and we have the power to change it. Keziah Weir writes on fashion, pop, and circumstance. Celine collaborated with artist Christian Marclay for a Wham Bam Wow update on classic looks. There's something inherently delightful in unexpected pairings. Champagne and fried chicken, Shaggy and Sting, Christmas in July. When the notes are right, what might be discordant just feels fresh. Such is the case with these accessories by Celine from the much-anticipated debut collection by creative director Eddie Slimani. The pumps and handbag are each a classic shape, sheathed in a whimsical print, courtesy of the visual artist and composer Christian Marclay, who embellished the time-honored looks with colorful onomatopoeias pulled from the pages of vintage comic books. A new take on a timeless look makes sense for Marclay. Temporality is a dominant theme for the artist, known for his masterwork, The Clock, a 24-hour montage of film clips synchronized to the real second. And while the graphic print on traditional styles may be surprising, Marclay says that his collaboration with Slimani is anything but fashion. Fashion, Marclay says, is simply wearable pop sculpture, three-dimensional objects in motion. A fitting description of this sparkly pair, which delivers an infusion of art from finger to foot. Photograph by Kieran Monahan and Theo Vamvanakis, showing a small handbag in velvet and shoes also in velvet that have various sound effects on them, peep and beep, and all the other little things that you see written on the pages of comic books. All little soundbite expressions seen around photographs in comic books, around the drawings, rather, in comic books, somehow transporting these shoes and handbag to a different level of pop culture. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service and broadcasting from its Raleigh, North Carolina studios. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.